I'm the speaker chair, as you can see, and I got the opportunity to listen to all kinds of different podcasts. There's so much available out there online, especially in the height of COVID. You know, you're sitting at work not doing anything, and so I use that time to listen to various speakers from all over the world. And so in June of this year, tonight y'all will get to meet Cliff, but I spoke with various speakers. And when I talked to Cliff, he asked me if we were also looking for an Al-Anon speaker. And I was like, well, yes, we are. And I hadn't even had an opportunity to really do any research yet on Al-Anon. And so he sent me his wife, Lori's, a podcast that she had done that I had listened to. And, you know I'm alcoholic and I know I'm codependent. So once I listened to Lori's message on Al-Anon, I thought, well, maybe I need to start going to Al-Anon too. So, and of course, when I spoke with Lori, she was so happy and eager to come and share her message with us today. So, her home group is Start Fresh from Oklahoma City. So, if y'all would please give a nice warm welcome to Lori from Oklahoma.
Hey, everybody. Hey, y'all. My name is Lori Gidding. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hey, Lori.
My recovery date is July 1st, 2001, and my home group is Start Fresh. We meet Mondays at 5:30 at a place called the Western Club in Oklahoma City. So glad you all got up this morning. I'm glad I got up this morning. I'm not a morning person. You ask my husband. We are total opposites in that. He gets up singing and happy, and I'm like, get me my coffee. And don't talk to me for like an hour, and then I'm good. And so 10 is actually good for me. It's the 9 a.m.s that kind of I struggle with. So anyway, we're glad to be here. We had an easy flight in, and we went and ate at the Pit last night. I'm going to tell you, that was some good food. And we had breakfast at like 9 o'clock last night. It was great. Anyway, so... Okay, I'm here to tell my experience, strength, and hope, so let's just get on with that so we can get over it and get on to lunch. All right, so I was born, and when I was born, I had two older sisters and an older brother waiting on me. My oldest sister is 11 years older than me, and she has drank, smoked, taken a pill, done something since I can remember, and she doesn't think she's an alcoholic, and she doesn't think she has a problem, and I got to be honest with you, I don't know if she is or not. I really don't, but she gives a good impression of one. And I got a sister that is 10 years older than me, and she actually came into the rooms of AA about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, and she stayed for about 7 years, and about 7 years after she came into the room, she called me crying. And I go, what is wrong? And she goes, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And I go, why are you crying? And she goes, because I really want to be. And I said, oh my God, what is wrong with you? I said, what do you mean? And she said, I feel like a fake and a fraud in those meetings. She said, I don't identify with a lot of those things in the book. And I've been back through the steps with my sponsor again. And she says, I can't tell you if you're an alcoholic or not, but you're not an alcoholic. And sure enough, she's not. And I said, well, why did you go to AA in the first place? And she said, well, if I'm being honest, I thought my husband would follow me into the rooms. And I said, welcome to Al-Anon. And she is now a member of Al-Anon. And then I have a brother that is 6 years older than me. I still say that. Had a brother that was 6 years older than me. And he died of this disease 2.5 years, almost 3 years ago now. And he died the alcoholic death that is described in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother was 6'5 and weighed 135 pounds. And the last thing that he said on this earth was that he loved me. And I'm going to tell you, that's a big deal for me because my brother, for the most of his life, I had tried to get him to do and be what I wanted him to do and be. And I got into these rooms and you told me to love him and for who he was and what he was. And I learned that here. And we had the best relationship you can have during active alcoholism. I do really believe that. And we had some really good conversations, and I had a lot of that. I got my amends done with him, and I got to have a clean slate with him the day that he died. But he was my best friend growing up, and when he died, I had lost him a long, long time ago. Alcoholism had taken my brother a long, long time ago. He'd been drinking his whole life, and he literally drank himself to death. And then there's me, and I'm the baby of the bunch, and I have never drank or done a drug in my whole entire life. I know, I'm just going to let that sink in. Because the alcoholics are looking at me like, what is wrong with you? And you know what I know about that? You know, when you say that out in the real world, people go say stuff like this to you. Oh, that's so cool, and I'm so proud of you. That's really neat. You say that in a group of Al-Anons, they go, you are really sick. And they would be right. And you know, what I know about that today is that was all about control. That was all about control. Even though I didn't know anything about alcoholism or alcoholics, I didn't know anything about the disease, I didn't know anything about that. What I knew is that when my brother drank and when my sisters drank, it seemed like they got in a lot of trouble and they disappointed my parents and it seemed like they were having a lot of issues and I wasn't going to be like them. And I thought that if I did not drink or do drugs, that even though I didn't know what alcoholism was, I wasn't going to be affected. You know, I was going to be different than them. I was going to be able to lead a different life than them. Obviously, that worked out well for me. Look where I am. But that's what it was about. It was about control. And I know that now, but I didn't know that then. I grew up in a little town. We lived in the country. My daddy is the hardest working man I've ever met in my life. My daddy was as old as everybody else's grandparents. My daddy was in World War II. He grew up during the Depression, and we worked hard. He taught us how to work hard. We had a work ethic, and we worked hard, and that's what we did our whole lives. We had a little 10 acres, and we had beef cattle and dairy cattle and a huge, huge, gigantic garden, and we lived off the land pretty much. But that's just how I grew up. And my daddy started the Trinity Bible Baptist Church in a place called Choctaw, Oklahoma. He was not a minister or preacher. Do not get me wrong. He was not. But he was the deacon for the church, and he was the song leader. And we had church services in our home before he started that church. I'm told. I don't remember. I was a little girl then. But I remember that church, and I remember growing up in that church, and I loved everything about that town. I mean, it's a small town. Everybody knew everybody. I knew them. They knew us. We had a lot of fun. I had a great life. My parents are not alcoholics. They're just not. Not my story. I had a really good life, and everything was going good. And then I turned 7. And when I turned 7, my parents divorced. And they kicked my dad out of that church that he started, and my mom moved us to a suburb of Oklahoma City called Moore, Oklahoma. And I hated it. I hated it there. And I hated it for a number of reasons. One, because we were in the city, and two, it was just so different than anything I'd ever been around in my life. And three, kids were mean to me for the first time in my life. I mean, nobody had ever teased me or been mean to me or anything like that until I moved. And kids were mean to me. One, because I had this accent, which is a lot better than it used to be. And two, because I was the ugliest kid in school. I was the ugliest kid in school. I'm going to tell you what I look like. If you would like to see pictures, my husband has some on his phone. He would be happy to show you. But I had buck teeth really, really bad. And then I had these eye teeth that were growing out through my gums because my baby teeth wouldn't fall out. So I looked like a vampire bunny. And I had this big nose. I got my nose fixed in my 20s. My doctor said, your nose would look better on a man. I go, it does. It's my daddy's nose. Looks great on him, not so much on me. Had these big, thick glasses because I couldn't see 3 feet in front of my face. Had long, stringy hair. I was a tomboy because my brother had 2 older sisters. He wanted a little brother. He got me, so he did the best with what he had. And I was a tomboy. I was always in hand-me-down or garage sale clothes. I wasn't very hygienic, and I always played with boys. I always played football. I always climbed trees. I always raced them. I always did that. That's just where I was comfortable with because that's what my, you know, I was used to hanging out with my brother. And so they teased me, and they said stuff, you know, they called me names and tripped me going down the hall at school and threw things at me as I walked home. And so I was a latchkey kid. My mom worked during the day, and I was a latchkey kid, and I'd let myself in at home, and I stayed in my room or watched TV and read books most of the time, and I just didn't have any friends. I just didn't have any friends, and that was by choice because, see, what I taught myself, what I learned then was if you're going to hurt me, you're not going to get close to me. And so I kept everybody at a distance, and that's just the way I grew up, and I don't see that to be dramatic or, oh, poor you. That's just the way that it was. It's just what I did. And so when I was 13, and here's the other thing. My mom didn't do well with the divorce. She didn't want a divorce. And so she had friends and people that started taking her out. And she started going out on weekends. And at first it was like every other weekend. And then it was every weekend. And then it was every weekend plus ladies' night. And so From the time that I was 8 until I was about 13, my mom would leave me home for days at a time. I mean, a lot of times she'd leave on Friday to go to work, and then I wouldn't hear from her again until Monday morning when she called me and told me to get up and get ready to go to school. And that's just the way I thought it was when you have divorced parents. And it wasn't like that at my dad's house. I mean, when I went to my dad's house, we went over to his girlfriend's house. I hated her. And we'd go over there. And my dad had rules, and he was strict, and I followed the rules, and you know, he was disciplined with me and structured, and it was just different at my dad's house. But at my mom's house, I could do whatever I wanted to, and I had no rules, and there was nobody telling me no, and there was nobody around. And then I turned 13, and both of my parents got married. My dad married that woman I hated, and my mom met my stepdad. And my stepdad did a lot of good things for me, I'm just going to tell you. But he became the parent in my household, and I had never had that before, and it was a really hard adjustment. And it seemed like we were always battling. But he was really strict with me, and he taught me a lot of things, and he did a lot of good things for me, and I want you to hear that. He got my teeth fixed. He got me contacts. He taught me a lot of stuff that I didn't know about. He was really smart. He'd been around the world. He knew everything. But he and I had a tough relationship. And what happened at the end of that relationship is when I turned 16, I caught him watching me take showers through the skylight of the roof, on the roof. And so I called my, I ta- caught him, I had caught him a couple of times, and I knew he was up there, and so I told my mom. It was 11:30 at night, and I went and got my mom, and she caught him on the roof. And when he came down, she said, "What were you doing on the roof?" And he said, "I was cleaning the gutters." Now, I don't know when you clean the gutters, but 11:30 at night is a good time, and because there's nobody up there, and there's no traffic. It's just easy to do. But I don't think my mom believed him. I don't know, but my mom was scared. I know that. And what happened was I got asked to leave that house a couple of months later, which was fine with me because now I got to go live with my daddy because I'm a daddy's girl, and I love my daddy. I didn't like his girlfriend and now his wife, but I love my daddy. And so I moved in with my dad, and you know, the only problem with that is that my dad was dying at the time. We have a kidney disease that runs in our family, and he was on a dialysis machine 3 times a week, and he was going, and I knew he wasn't going to make it much longer. And so I did with him what I do with those kids, is that if you're going to hurt me, you're not going to get close to me. And so I just kept really busy because I figured if I kept distancing myself when he died, it wouldn't hurt as bad. If I was too close to him, it was going to cause more pain. Again, a way of me trying to control, which does not work, by the way. But that was my thought process, and so I stayed really busy, and then the week of my high school graduation, the absolute Monday before my high school graduation, my dad got a kidney transplant and saved his life, and he and I had a lot of good times after that, and we spent a lot of good time together, and we went to the lake a lot. We had a lake house, and we went fishing a lot and ran trot lines, and we did all the things that we like to do, and I had a lot of good time. I was having a really good time with my dad, and I liked living there. And I graduated from school, and I worked at a bank right down the street. And my dad loved it. I could come home for lunch, and we were having a good time. And I turned 19, and I met him. And my daddy hated him. And I met him in September. He asked me to marry him in November. We got married in March, and my daddy hated him. And you know, at 19, I don't know how you were, but I thought I knew everything, and you couldn't tell me anything. And people tried to tell me, you know, I was 19, he was 27. This is a big mistake. You need to think about this. But I knew everything, and I'm going to tell you that does not stop at 19. I think I know everything my whole life. I've always thought that I knew more than you. I always thought I knew better. That is a problem that comes up a lot. So. Just be warned. And so anyway, we get married. I instantly know it's the biggest mistake of my life. I mean, instantly know it's the biggest mistake of my life. But if you're somebody like me, you can't admit that because I'm never wrong. I don't apologize. I don't make mistakes. And so I can't admit that. And so what I do is I do what I know to do. I'm going to make this work. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to make this work. I'm going to do whatever I can to make this work. And so we stay married about 3 or 4 years into it. We have a little boy. And because if you have a bad marriage, get pregnant. That's always a solution. And so, and you know, and it does fix it for a while. I'm going to tell you, you get a baby and the newness of everybody's all happy and stuff. But that's not a fix, you know. It's just a distraction. And so we'd been married about 7 years. I was miserable. I tried everything to make that marriage work and to make me happy, and nothing was working. And by this time, well, I'm back in the country, and I'm driving an hour to the city every day to go to work, and my way out of my marriage walks through the door. He was the best-looking thing I've ever seen. He was 5'6". I don't know what it is about short guys. I love short guys. I do. I like the short guys. If you're short, I'm going to like you. If you're short and alcoholic, I'm going to love you. And I love this one. He is 5'6". He had these baby blue eyes. He had this dark brown hair. He had this great tan. He always was dressed to the nines. I mean, every time he walked in the door, he looked really good. And every time he'd walk in the door, all the girls would giggle and smile at him and bat their eyes, and all the guys would shake his hand and pat him on the back. He was the attorney for the bank. He was on our board of directors, and he was on my loan approval committee. And literally, when he walked in the bank, every time he walked in, I would go to another room because I could not form a sentence around him, which had never happened before or since. And one day, he called me and asked me to bring a file down to his office downtown, and he said, "I'll take you to lunch," and I did, and he took me to lunch, and that was it. I started dating him, and I left my husband. And I'm going to tell you, you need to hear that, because that's the order it came in, and I am not proud of that. And that is not a recommendation, by the way, but that's what happened. And the reason why I need to be honest with that about that is because I lied about that to a lot of people for a lot of years. Because I don't know how you are, but if you're somebody like me, let me tell you how that goes. Somebody who actually had enough nerve to try to breach the subject or talk to me about it, if they actually had enough nerve to ask me about it, what I would say is, "Oh, we were separated long before I started dating him. And we were separated. He was in the garage, I was in the kitchen. We were separated." Or I would say, "You know, my marriage was over long before I started dating him," which was true. My husband at the time just did not know that that was the case. And that's how I do things, because I got to look good. I got to be right. I don't make mistakes. I am not going to apologize. I'm just going to tell you, I never apologized to anyone for anything, because it was always somebody else's fault. Always. And so I start dating this guy, and he's crazy. I mean, crazy. I mean, he's a lot of fun, though. Don't get me wrong. We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun no matter what we did. We had fun watching TV or going to eat or talking on the phone. We had a lot of fun. But I noticed after a while that he doesn't sleep very well, like for days at a time. And then he sleeps for days at a time. And I have never known anybody to be able to do that. I mean, I can barely make it through a slumber party. So I am trying to figure that out. And so I asked him about that one day, and I said, "How come you don't sleep?" And he goes, "Oh, I have a sleeping disorder. I've had it since college." And I don't know what happens if you get information like that, but when I get information like that, you are now my project. And so I said, "You know, you need to go see a doctor about that. We need to get that figured out." And he said, "Oh, I've seen doctors and I've seen done sleep studies, and they can't figure it out." Again, normal people might take that okay, but not me. I go, "You haven't been to the right doctors. Let me figure this out for you. Now, let me just explain something to you. He did not ask for my help. I am volunteering this help." There's a lady in my home group. Her name is Mary. And when I first got into Al-Anon, I mean, within the first, I don't know, several months of me, you know, being in Al-Anon, she said something to me, and I'll never forget it. And she says that, and everybody at home knows that this is from her. But she said, we were talking about being helpful, and she goes, "You know, helpfulness is the sunny side of control." And so just remember that if you're trying to be helpful. So I was helping him to figure out what was going on with him, and you know, and I'm trying to figure it out, and I don't know what I really can't figure it out. And so I do what anybody would do in that situation. I move in with him, because you got to watch him 24/7, because I'm pretty sure he's just drinking too many Dr. Peppers and too much screen time. I'm going to find out. And so I move in with him, and I start inquiring more about it, and I start looking and following him around and trying to decide what's going on. And he gets a little irritated with me about that, and we start having little arguments. And I'm just going to tell you, it's no big deal. We just have these little spats, and then he comes back and apologizes. Notice I say he comes back and apologizes, because, again, I do not. And it's okay, and then we go on. And you know, and at first it's no big deal. And and those start happening. And it seems like that the more that I start questioning and inquiring and looking and investigating, the more trouble we start having. And we start having fights now. I mean, like screaming fights and yelling fights. And again, you know, he comes back, apologizes, everything's good for a while. But those start becoming more frequent. And they start becoming longer and bigger and more of them. And one time we got in a particularly big fight and I left. And I went moved back to my apartment because you got to have a backup plan. And I always have to have that security blanket back there. So I moved back to my apartment and I'd been gone about 2 weeks and he called me. And I answered the phone and he said, "Don't hang up." And I said, "What?" And he said, "You know what I think we should do?" And I said, "What?" He goes, "I think we should go see a counselor." And I thought that was a great idea. And I'd never been to a counselor before. I'd never been to any kind of therapy. I didn't know anything about it. But I said, "Okay." Now, I don't know if anybody in here has ever been to therapy. I would guess not. But but I don't know what it's like where you go or might have gone to. But where we went, I went. She wanted to see me first. And she gave me this intake sheet to fill out. And, you know, and it had questions on it. And it had all these questions on it. And she said, I want you to fill this out. And when you're done, you know, I'll come in and look at it. And I was like, okay. So I look at it, and I start answering these questions. Now, there's questions on it like this. Have you ever drank more than two or three drinks at a time? Have you ever taken illegal drugs? Have you ever taken prescription drugs? Have you ever dressed promiscuously? Have you ever had more than two or three, two partners at a time? Have you ever had more than two or three drinks at a time? I am looking at this thing like checking no as fast as I can check no on it, thinking, who comes in here? I mean, I just need a little relationship advice. What is all this? And she comes out and she gets that piece of paper from me and she says, "You know, give me about 10 minutes to go over this and I'll be right back." And I said, "Okay." And she had barely walked through that door before she spun right back around, looked at that sheet, looked back at me, and she goes, "Well, the only thing sick about you is that you're dating Cliff Gooding. Let's talk about that." And that's what she said, and I'm going to tell you what I heard. "See, it's him, it's not you. He's the problem." And so we started going to counseling, but on that basis, that he was the problem. And so we start going to this counselor, and let me just say this. There were people that knew Cliff and knew me, and they would find out that we were dating, and they would call me up. And I can just tell you, this is the general conversation every time. This is basically what has happened every time. They'd say, "Is it true you're dating Cliff Gooding?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And I'd say, "Do you know him?" And they'd go, "Oh, yeah." And I'd say, "Well, tell me about him." And they go, "Well, you know, he's brilliant. He's super smart. He's one of probably the most brilliant men you'll ever meet in your life." And I knew that. He was super smart. He did his undergraduate in 3 years. And he said that the bar exam was the easiest exam he's ever taken in his life. And I worked hard to get a C in algebra in high school. Thank you very much. And so, and they'd say, "And he's, you know, he's really successful." Well, I knew that. He had this huge law firm downtown Oklahoma City when I met him. And they'd say, "And he's a lot of fun." Well, I knew that. I had a lot of fun with him. And they'd say, "But he's a liar, he's a cheat, he's arrogant, he's egotistical. You cannot trust him as far as you can throw him, and you need to stay away from him." And what I heard was, "He needs you." And that is the truth. That is exactly the truth. So we start going to this counselor, and after a while, he has convinced her that he is bipolar. And so she gives him medication for that. And so that now explains everything to me. That's why we can't sleep. That's why we can't eat. That's why we have high highs. That's why we have low lows. All this is because of the medication. So the medication is supposed to help. I mean, because of bipolar. So the medication is supposed to help with that. And it seems like it does for a while. And then we start on this roller coaster again. And now the medication is now the excuse. "I forgot to take it. I took too much. I didn't take the right amount. This is the wrong dose. They're going to have to switch it on me. I don't know what, you know." And these fights keep continuing. And by now, we're not talking fights. We're talking knockdown, drag out, slamming, throwing, screaming, cussing, yelling. It looks like World Wrestling Federation in our household some days. It is awful. It is awful. I'm going to tell you the worst thing about it. We have two little kids at that time when we got together. When we first got together, my son was 4 and his little daughter was 5. And I'm going to tell you, those kids have heard their parents say things to each other I wouldn't say to my worst enemy today. They've seen us treat each other. I would never treat another human being the way that I treated him. And those kids were there for a majority of that. And you know, when the disease of alcoholism is rampant in your house, and you have no idea, my only focus is him. All I care about is, what can I do to fix him? How can I get him to act right? What can I do to make sure that he does what he's supposed to do? And I am focused on him, and everybody else gets left on the wayside. And those kids were casualties of this. I'm just going to tell you. And I'm not proud of that, but that's the kind of parent I am. We got in a huge fight, and I'm just going to tell you, Cliff is not a violent man. He's just not. But you need to put enough drugs and alcohol into a man, you never know what's going to happen. And on this particular night, we got in a huge fight. I can't tell you what it was about. Apparently, it was really important, but I can't tell you what it was about. And for some reason, he actually lays hands on me at this time. And he grabbed me, and he is pulling me down the hall by my hair. And he's trying to slap at me. And I'm just going to tell you, I don't mean to make light of this. I'm not. But I am not a victim here. I signed up for every bit of it. I volunteered to be there every single day. I had plenty of opportunities to leave, and I just did not. And I was a tomboy, and because I had a little brother, I'm going to tell you, I give just as good as I get. I'm not saying that what happened there was right. It was not. He should have never laid hands on me, but I'm just going to tell you, what I did wasn't right either. And I punched and kicked right back at him. And he's dragging me down the hall, and my little boy was about 8 years old at the time. And he comes out of his room, and he sees all this, and he starts crying, and he's terrified. And I say, go back in your room. Because that's the kind of parent I am. Go back in your room. And I'm going to tell you, I don't know how that ended. We stopped fighting at some point, and the next day we went about our day, and it was never talked about. Nobody ever mentioned it. We just acted like it was just another normal day in the household. And you know, that occasion only happened once, but I can't tell you how many times we've had these horrible fights and screaming matches and stuff, and nobody said anything to those kids ever. One day we got in a fight, and he was real paranoid. All of a sudden he just became really paranoid, and he thought I was going to leave him. And I got a phone call from a client, and it happened to be a male, and he threw my phone up against the wall and said, I'm sure it's one of your boyfriends. That was fun to explain the next day. But anyway, and, you know, he starts telling me, you don't love me. You're going to leave. I know you don't love me, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, I do what anybody would do in that situation. I marry him. Because you got to prove how much you love him. We get married, and nothing changes, and that goes on for a while, and one day, we've been going to this counselor, and finally she got sick of us, and she sent us somewhere else. She did. She was like, I can't do anything else with you, and so she sent us to this other lady. And this lady had him figured out in like 2 visits. I did not know that, but she did. And what I now know is that at the time that we went to her, she had about 8 years of Al-Anon. But she had figured him out. And on our third visit in, I said, I can't. Again, he's been up for days at a time. I'm about to pull my hair out. And she's like, okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you a prescription for tranquilizers. I want you to give him one at 6 o'clock. If he's not in bed by 10, asleep by 10, you give him another one, and then you just go to bed. And I said, okay. And that's exactly what I did. I gave him one at 6. I gave him another one at 10. I got up the next morning. He was not in bed with me, which at this time is not an uncommon occurrence, because a lot of times I find him the next morning, he's either on the couch or he's in our guest room on the other side of the house. And this particular morning, he was in the guest room on the other side of the house. And I go to wake him up because we're supposed to go get his daughter from camp that morning. And I go to wake him up, and I go to open the door, and it is barricaded shut with a love seat. And the other door leading in from the bathroom is locked. And that had never happened before. And I'm just going to tell you, I don't know how you guys are, but if you are an untreated Al-Anon of my type, a love seat is no barricade for us. I'm just going to tell you, if we need to get to our drunk person, we can find you anywhere. We can get to you anywhere. I don't care if you're in the middle of Fort Knox. If I need to get you, I will find you. We have this innate ability, I think we're born with it, that we can seek and find and retrieve any alcoholic that we need to. It's just... it's just a gift. And I'm still convinced to this day, if you would have told a group of untreated Al-Anons that Osama bin Laden was a drunk and his family needed him at home, there would have been no need for military action. We could have gotten him. I'm just telling you. And so so I break in on him, and he's passed out in bed and naked to the world. And next to him in the, on the floor of the bed is an empty bottle of wine, an empty bottle of vodka, and up next to the adult tapes that had been that he had pulled up, on top of the adult tapes that had ran out, was this little clear package with some white substance in it. And that's how I found out what was going on. People used to say to me, "Oh, you were just in denial." I go, "No, I was just an idiot. I was just oblivious. I had no idea. I really had no idea." And so I hit him as hard as I could hit another human being, and he popped up out of that bed, and I shook that package at him, and I said, "What the heck is this?" Those are not my exact words, but let's just go with that. And he looked at that package, he looked at me, and he goes, "I don't know." When Cliff gets to tell this story, he always likes to say, "I guess those people that barricaded me in here must have dropped it on their way out." Anyway, another fight ensued, and I told him to leave, and he did. And he came back a couple hours later, and I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "This is my house. I live here." And I said, "Not today." I said, "You're not staying here." And he goes, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And I said, "I want you to go tell Wilma what's been going on." Now, Wilma is his daughter's mother. And at the time, Wilma had about 13 or 14 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "Okay," and he left, and he came back a couple hours later, and I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, I live here." And I said, "You're still drunk. I just told you. You're not staying here." And he said, no, "I went and did what you said. I went and told Wilma. We had a talk. She took me to a meeting, and we're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I had no idea what he was talking about, and I didn't care. And I was like, "That's great, but you're not staying here." And he said, "Okay." And so he left. And I called Wilma, and I would love to tell you that I called Wilma because she had 13 or 14 years in this program, and I knew that she was going to give me some insight, but I called Wilma to check up on him. That's the only reason I called her. And I said, "Did he tell you what he's been doing?" And she said, "Yeah." And I took him to a meeting, and we're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. Still had no idea what she was talking about, and I still did not care. And I said, "Well, that's great. What do I do?" And she said, "Would you be willing to go to a meeting with me tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes." Now I'm going to tell you why I said yes. It's not because I had a problem. It's not because I needed Al-Anon. I'm going to tell you why I said yes. Because I tried everything in the world to get that man to do and act the way that I thought he should do and act. And I was out of ideas. Well, that's not entirely true. I had one idea left. I was going to kill him. I kind of planned it. I kind of figured it out. Knew how I was going to get away with it. Because I'm going to tell you, I'm convinced that one of the worst things that can happen for untreated Al-Anons is for us to watch too many episodes of Forensic Files and 48 Hours. We have planned your death so many times, and we are sure we have learned from those people's mistakes, and we're pretty sure we can get away with it. I'm just telling you. So I was out of ideas, and let me just tell you something. I had tried everything. I've searched through cars, pocketbooks, glove boxes. I have searched through closets. I have followed him. I have followed him to work. I have driven by places where he's supposed to be or should be. I've searched through emails. I've listened to voicemails. I've done everything. I have threatened. I have begged. I have cried. I have pleaded. I've punished. I'm a good punisher. I've done everything to get him to do and act the way that I thought he should do and act. And none of it worked. I said that one time at a conference, and the lady came up to me afterwards. She goes, "How did you get his passcodes to his email and his phone?" And I went, "You may not qualify for this program. It's kind of a rookie move for people like us. I mean, we just know." Anyway. So, So, like I said, I didn't have any place else to go. I didn't have anything else to do. So I said I'd go to this meeting, and she took me to my very first meeting of Al-Anon. And she took me to my second meeting, and she took me to my third meeting. And I don't know how you guys got here, but I got here with the ex-wife. And I don't know if I'll ever be able to repay that debt, because I didn't want to be here. And I certainly didn't think that I needed to be here. But I started listening, and I started hearing some stuff. And you guys were talking about the way I felt. And 45 days later, Cliff's going to meetings, and about 45 days later, he relapses. And I catch him at the door, and I go, "You've been drinking." And he's like, "No, I haven't." I go, "And I think you've been using." He goes, "No, I haven't." I go, "Well, we're going to do a drug test." And he's like, "You're being a little harsh." And we got in another fight. Once again, I told him to leave, and once again, I called Wilma, and she said, "You know what I think we should do?" And I said, "What?" She said, "I think we should get supervised visitation with our kids." And I thought that was a great idea. And I wish I could stand up here and tell you I did that because I needed to protect my kids from him. I did that to punish him. You drink and relapse on me, by God, I'll show you. I'll teach you. So we go see this attorney who happens to be a member of AA. And when we got there, she said, "Hey, do you want a divorce?" And I said, "No, I don't want a divorce." And she said, "Well, what do you want?" And I said, "I just want him to be okay." And that was really the best I had. That was really the truth. Really. And she said, "Well, if that's true, and you really mean that," she said, "then you need to figure out what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do." And she said, "And you need to be really sure of those decisions." And she said, "And you don't say anything you don't mean. And you don't mean anything you don't say. And you don't threaten. Whatever you say, you got to be willing to follow through with. And you got to figure out what that is for you." And then she said, "And then you need to tell him what that is. But when you go to tell him that, you need to be really calm." Now I'm just going to tell you, there are 1,000 adjectives that can describe me. Calm ain't making the list. Nobody has ever said to me in my whole entire life, "You know what I like about you, Laura? You're just so calm." I mean, it has never happened. Because I don't know calm. I don't know what calm is. I've never been around calm. I thrive on chaos. I mean, that's my jam. That's where I live. That is my wheelhouse. Is chaos, crazy. That I don't know about calm. But I've been going to Al-Anon, and for 45 days I've been going to Al-Anon. The only thing that had stuck in my brain, the only thing that I had learned, was the Serenity Prayer. And so at the time I had a really good job. As for the last 3 years of Cliff's drinking, he had not had a sober day and had not been working. And I had been supporting us for over 3 years. And I had a really good job, and I was in sales, and I drove around a lot in my car. And on that particular day, what I did is I just drove around all day long, and I said the Serenity Prayer over and over again. And I'm going to tell you, if I said it one time, I said it 500 times that day. It's the only thing I really knew. It's the only thing that I knew to do. And I prayed, and I said that prayer over and over, and then I called him, and I asked him to come home that night. I wanted to talk to him, and he said okay. And I came home from work, and he was waiting on me, and I grabbed his hands, and this is what I said. I said, "I know you have a problem, and I know this must be hard, and I know you're scared. And I'm willing to do whatever I need to do. If I have to go to meetings or counseling or treatment myself, I'll do that. I'm willing to do my part, but only if you can do your part. And if you can't do your part, I can't stay." And that may not sound like a big deal, but to me it was everything, because it was the first time in my whole entire life, since I was a little kid, that I was going to be okay. I knew in my heart I was going to be okay. Because I've never been okay without him. Whether it was him, or the him before him, or the him before him, I've always had to have the spot filled right next to me. I've never been okay on my own. I've never felt okay in my own skin. I've never been okay, ever. But when I said that to him, I knew no matter what happened, I was going to be okay. I knew in my heart, my soul, and my gut that no matter what he said, I was going to be okay. If he would have said, "Screw you, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, and if you don't like it, you can leave," I knew it was going to be okay. But that's not what he said. He said, "You're right. I have a problem." And he said, and he also let me know that he did not have a sleeping disorder and was not bipolar, which I had figured out by that time, but it was nice for the confirmation. And he said, and I said, "Well, what are you going to do differently?" Because I knew he'd been going to AA. I knew he'd been going to meetings. That's all he'd been doing. And he said, I'm going to ask a guy to sponsor me tomorrow, and I'm going to do whatever he asked me to do. And the next morning he got up and he asked that man to sponsor him, and he's been sober ever since. And that left me with me. And when the obsession in my life gets better, and I'm just going to meetings, because it works both ways, I get crazier. And so this is what's going on in our household. He's going to meetings. He's working with a sponsor. He's working with newcomers. He's taking the steps. He's doing everything they tell him to do. And I am a crazy woman, and this is what's going on. I am doing everything they tell you not to do in Al-Anon. I have made all the mistakes. I'm just going to tell you. So here's what's going on in our household. He comes in from work, and I'm like, what'd you do today? How many meetings did you go to? Who went with you? Did you talk to your sponsor? How many times have you talked to your sponsor? What meetings did you go to? Who was there? What did they talk about? What did you have for lunch? I gave you $20 this morning. How much do you have left? What are you doing tonight? Where are you going? I swear to you, because you don't just get sober and everything gets happy and rosy. We get into these arguments again. I didn't have a sponsor. I'd call his. And I'm not kidding. And so that was what was going on, and I am going to meetings. I'm going to meetings, and I am sharing about this in meetings, by the way. And I'm going to tell you, the thing about Al-Anon that is so great is when you are a newcomer and you come in here, they let you talk, and they just love you to death because they know that you're crazy. And they let you say whatever you need to say because they know this is the first time that you're in a place where it's safe and that everybody understands you're crazy. I mean, that's the truth. So I go in and I'm talking about this and I'm sharing about it, and they're saying, you know, oh, we're glad you're here. Keep coming back because that means you are really sick and you need to be here. And they're good and loving and kind until about month three. And about month three, they're like, okay, enough time has passed. We need to get her help. And so what happens is after a while, you're still sharing about all the crazy that's going on in your house. And they say, somebody says to me, I don't remember who it was, but somebody says to me, do you have a sponsor? And I was like, no, might want to get one of them. And so I thought, you know, that I probably should do that. I probably should. He seems to be doing great with this. I am not. And so maybe I need to get a sponsor. And there was this lady that I went to meetings with, and I loved her. And she was one of those, she was so nice. And every time that she shared, it felt like she was talking right to my heart. Have you ever had those? And I thought, oh my gosh, I just love her. So one day I ran after her after a meeting, and I said, look, I really need a sponsor. Would you please sponsor me? And she said, sure, here's my phone number. You call me tonight. And I said, okay. And so I got home that night and I called her, and she said, tell me why you think you need Al-Anon. So I told her everything he had ever done. He did this and he did that, and then I caught him with this, and then this happened. La, 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 la. And I to this day do not know if I paused or if I had stopped. I really don't know. But anyway, I took a breath, and she finally got in there, and she goes, well, now we know he's not the problem. You are. Maybe we could work on that. And I was like, but it's exactly what I needed to hear. My first thought was, you seem so nice in those meetings. My second thought was, oh my God, she's right. And this is what clicked in my head. I am powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable by me. And it had absolutely nothing to do with him. And until she said that to me, it still wasn't my fault. It was still him. I could still blame him. And she says, okay, we're going to start taking these steps. And so I said, okay. And so she walked me through the powerless and unmanageability in my life in step one. And we talked about the insanity in step two. And I'm just going to tell you, I didn't think I was insane until she said, have you ever heard the definition of insanity? And I said, no. And she said, it's doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. And I'm going to tell you, that hit home for me. Because every time that I tried all that stuff that I talked to you about before, searching, looking, threatening, begging, pleading, crying, every single time that I did any of those things, every single time, I thought, this is the day he's going to hear it. This is the day it's going to work. This is the day it's going to change. Every single time. And then we got to step three, and I'm just going to tell you, I grew up in church. I was the only one that still kept going to church after my family divorced. nobody else in my family went to church except for me. My mom would go in between men, but other than that, I was the only one that continued to go. And what I know about that now is that I was seeking, I was looking, I was trying to figure it out, and I just didn't have it. And so I thought step three was going to be a no-brainer for me. And I'm going to tell you, it was the hardest step I took. It was the hardest step I've taken. My sponsor said to me, "Do you trust God?" And I said, "Yes." She goes, "No, you don't." And I was like, "Yes, I do." She's like, "No, you don't." And I was like, "Why would you say that?" She said, "Because you've been trying to do his job your whole entire life." And she was right. She said, "When's the last time you gave anything to God, anything to your higher power, where you didn't try to manipulate, force, coerce, and try to get your way? You didn't put your hands back on it and try to figure it out yourself. Tell me the last time that that happened. Just give me an example." I had nothing. The only thing I could think of is that when my son was born, when he was 3 days old, he had to have open heart surgery. I gave that to God. Had I been a surgeon, probably not. It's the only time God got anything from me is when I had absolutely no other options. That's the only time he got anything from me, because I can figure it out myself. Thank you very much. And so she said, "We're going to start practicing trust in God, and we're going to give him our day, and you're going to start practicing every single day trust in God. Get started on your four step." And so I did. And I got down with my four step, and I called her, and she said, "You're going to do your fifth step this Saturday at 10 o'clock at my house. I'll see you then." And I said, "Okay." And it was fall break, and it was on a Friday, and at the time this was all going on, we had remodeled our kids' rooms, and the only thing left to do in our daughter's room was to get her bedding. That was it. It was on a Friday. I'm at work. My husband calls me and he said, "Hey, guess what we did today?" And I said, "What?" He goes, "We went and got Rachel's bedding." And my thought was, how dare you? How dare you do that without me? How dare you do it without my approval, without my input? How dare you? I didn't say that because I had a sponsor. I just said, "Okay." And I hung up the phone and I got home that night and I said, "Let me see what you got." And so they brought it out and they showed me. And I said, "You know what? This color doesn't even match our room. And this material is so thin, she is going to tear it up in no time. And you spent way too much money on this." You know, he tried to do a nice, decent thing, and I just once again tore him to shreds. And the next morning I got up and I took that stuff and I threw it in the trunk of the car because I know better. Because I'm always right. And because I'm going to take it back and get what she should have gotten. And I throw it in the trunk of my car and I go to do my fifth step. Yeah, exactly. This does not end well. So I get there and we get started on my fifth step, and we had not gotten hardly anywhere. And she said, "Hold on, I need to go get something to drink. I'll be right back." And so she comes back with a glass of water and she says, "Okay, now listen, before we get started anymore, is there anything that might have happened that's not on this fifth step that you want to talk about?" And I thought, oh my God, he called her. And I said, "Yes." And she said, "What is it?" And so I told her about the bedding. She said, "Do you know what you did when you did that?" I said, "Yes. Once again, I had to have my way and I had to be right." And she said, "Oh no, that's not what you did." She said, "When you told her that that color didn't match her room, you had told her her opinion didn't matter. When you told her that material was so thin she'd tear it up in no time, you let her know that no matter what decision she made for the rest of her life, you would always know better. And when you told her that they spent too much money on it, you told her she wasn't worth it. You see, those are the exact nature of my wrongs. It's not the big stuff I can see. It's those little things that I do to people every single day because I'm right and I know better that does all the damage in the world. And the worst part of it is, I never gave it a thought. I'd been doing that to people my whole life, to everybody in my life. If you listen to me, if you do what I tell you to do, if you would just pay attention here, we'd all be okay, because I know better. I'm always right. I do that to everybody. And I've never even noticed it. We go back through my four step and we identify the exact nature of my wrongs in every area, in every relationship of my life. I'm going to tell you, when I got done with that four step and that fifth step, when I finished that, there was no problem with me being entirely ready. I did not want to be that person anymore. It is now clear to me who I am and what I have done. and the damage I have done on my own without any help of the alcoholic, by the way. I did that way before I ever married him. It's clear to me. I can't hide it anymore. I can't justify that behavior anymore. I can't make that okay anymore. I was entirely ready. I did not want to be that person anymore. She said, you don't have to change anything. You have to change everything. And she said, but you don't have to do it overnight. It took you a long time to get this way. It's going to take a little bit of time to get this knot unraveled. But we're going to do it one day at a time. So she sent me home to make sure that I reviewed and made sure I didn't leave anything out. And I did that, and I got on my knees and I asked God to remove these defects of character. We made my defects of character list. We went over that. I asked God to remove those. And then I made my 8-step list. And I said about my amends. And I'm going to tell you what happened when I divorced my first husband is he did not want a divorce, and he was not happy about anything that was going on. And he told me, he said, if you leave me, I'm going to do everything I can to make you pay for this. And I'm going to ruin you. I'm going to do anything that I can. And the only thing that he tried a lot of things, but the one thing that he was successful was is he got custody of our little boy. And I thought that was the worst thing that could ever happen. And I was angry and mad because he got custody and he didn't deserve custody. And I was a good mom. And I mean, through all that. And what I realized by doing this inventory is that that little boy had seen enough horrors on the weekends and in the summers. I can't imagine what it would have been like had he been there full time. And God knew exactly what he was doing when he let my husband have custody. He was in a safe home, in a good environment, at a good school, and he was happy. But had I had my way and been selfish, no telling what would have happened to that kid. He would have probably been taken away from me. He sure as heck should have been. And so one day, I don't remember if I was dropping off or picking up, but I said to my ex-husband, I said, can I talk to you? And he's like, sure. And I know he was thinking, God, what now? Because I had hassled him for years. And I said, I just need to tell you something. I want to thank you for being such a good dad to Colby. I want to tell you what a good job you've done and how much I appreciate it. He turned white. I was pretty sure he was going to pass out in the parking lot, so I left. And I hadn't gotten very far down the road, about 5 minutes, and he called me. And he said, I can't tell you what that means to me. He said, you know, I didn't think I'd done a very good job. I sure as heck didn't think you thought that. And somehow after that, he got better. And we kind of got along after that. When I got kicked out of that house, my stepdad kicked me out of that house when I was 16. And I moved in with my dad. I didn't talk to my mom after that for like 3 years. I didn't talk to her at all for 3 years. And I hadn't talked to her much since then, to be honest with you. I hadn't hardly talked to her at all. And my sponsor made me start emailing her every week. And then she made me start calling her every week. And I was doing that. And one day she brought up, when I was talking to her, she brought up how I was raised. And she said to me, I can't tell you how many times I've cried myself to sleep for the things that I allowed happen to you and the way that you were raised. And out of my mouth came, well, Mom, you need to learn to forgive yourself because I've forgiven you a long time ago. And it was the truth, and I can't even tell you when it happened. I can't even tell you when it happened. My mom is still alive. She's 89 years old. And, you know, and I honestly, she lives about 2 hours away, and I talk to her on the phone, and we get along fine. I don't see her a whole lot. She has not changed. I actually like being around her, and we have a lot of fun when I am around her. But I called her a couple of months ago, and we were talking, and all of a sudden she brought up the vaccine, you know, and she said, did you get it? And I was like, well, yeah, I got it. You know, I have this kidney disease. I got it. You know, I got it. She's like, oh, and I go, did you not get it? And she said, no. And look, I don't care. Get the thing. Don't get the thing. None of my business. Don't care. But I was just kind of curious. I go, well, Mom, you know, because she's 89. I said, why did you choose not to get it? And I swear to you, this was her answer. She goes, I'm worried about the long-term effects. Okay. 89. I think that's a good outlook. Whatever. Anyway. But you know, she and I have a good relationship today. We really do. And she knows I would do anything in the world for her. And anyway, and I made the rest of my amends. I did all my amends. My dad died a month before I got into this program. And I'm fortunate and blessed, and I know this is not everybody's story, that I did not have any amends to make to my dad. I had done those. I had done everything I could to be a good daughter to him. And I am so grateful for that, because when I went through the amends process, I had to go look and think, is there anything that I hadn't said to him or hadn't done to try to make that right? And there wasn't. We had really had a good relationship, and I had really been a good daughter to him, and I knew that. But I had other people that I had to make amends, and I did that. My stepdad had died, and I made amends at his graveside. What I know about my stepdad now is that he was probably alcoholic. When I got in this program, my sponsor asked me, she said, do you think your stepdad's an alcoholic? And I said, no. And she said, well, doesn't he drink? And I go, well, yeah, he drinks every day. She goes, well, tell me about that. And I said, well, he drinks beer like I drink water. And he did. He drank beer every day, all day long. And I said, and at night he'd have an Ezra Brooks and Coke sometimes too. And she'd say, well, why do you think he's not alcoholic? And I said, I've never seen him drunk. She goes, how do you know you've never seen him sober? And I had never thought of that. And that's the truth. What I know now today is that he was probably alcoholic. I will tell you, he had all the isms of alcoholism. Absolutely every one of them. I do a 10th step and 11th step. I review my day. I make sure that my side of the street is cleared up pretty much today. I can actually apologize today. I really do try to own myself, my part. The first time that I apologized to my husband, this is not a joke. This is a true story. I wish it was a joke, but it's not. I had to call him on his cell phone. I had been cranky that morning to him and short with him. I had to call and apologize, and he was in court, and so I had to leave it on his voicemail. And I'm going to tell you, he kept that voicemail to that phone, Dad. And he would just absolutely every once in a while come around and go, have you heard this? And listen to this apology. Because it was such a rare thing. He had never heard it before. And so sometimes I think he just played when he thought he needed an apology from me. I mean, I'm just telling you, made him feel better. The 11th step is super, super, super important to me. Every day I start on my knees and I do the 3rd and 7th step prayer. And sometimes I read the 11th step, but I do prayer and meditation every single morning because I got to get to God before I get to you, I promise you. And it sets my tone of my day, because that doesn't mean that I'm always going to have a great day, but I'm going to tell you, when stuff happens, it makes it a lot easier to deal with when I've started with God. And I do it every single morning. I have my time every morning. And it's critical to how I go about my day. It just is. And I start out that way, but I'm just going to tell you, I talk to God in my head all day long. All day long. We have conversations all day long. Sometimes it's really good, and sometimes it's like, okay, you're thinking again. Don't do that. You know, God speaks to me all the time. I think he speaks to me in so many ways. He always gets his message to me. I just never know in what form it's going to come. And 12th step is really important, and I love the 12th step, but I get a little soapboxy on it, so give me a minute. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, which is a promise, if you take these steps, you will get a spiritual awakening. I would argue you get more than one, but you get at least one. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others in our program, because we tried carrying it to y'all. Y'all don't listen. And you can't hear it from us. I did not know that. Carried this message to others. And we practiced these principles in all our affairs. And man, that is the kicker. Really? What does that mean? We practiced these principles in all of our affairs. I'll tell you what that means. That means if I can go buy me a cute little pair of shoes, but I can't pay the electric bill, I am not practicing these principles in all my affairs. That means that if my doctor says to me, hey, your cholesterol's up or you're a little overweight, which he has, and you need to ratchet it back, you need to watch your diet. But every time I sit down, I eat like I am going to the electric chair. I am not practicing these principles in all my affairs. That means if I can get up here and seem real spiritual and seem like I'm such a great AA Al-Anon member, but then I go home and I yell at my husband or I treat my kids horrible or I talk to my coworkers like they're less than, I'm not practicing these principles in all my affairs. That means that if I sit up here and I tell you how much I love my husband, which is absolutely true, we've been together now. We've been married 22 years, and we've been together 27, 26, something like that, almost 27. And we do. We have a great marriage, seriously have a great marriage. I mean, he's the man I've always dreamed of. That's the truth. And I tell you that, but then I flirt with some guy out in the hallway. I'm not practicing these principles in all my affairs. If I have this, you know, great relationship with my husband, but then I have to look at little pornography on the side or look at some sex videos on the side, I'm not practicing these principles in all my affairs. You see, I don't get to pick and choose today on those. It's in every area of my life all the time. It says practice. That means that we attempt. We do the best that we can. We're going to make mistakes. It's going to happen. We practice these principles in all of our affairs. When my dad died, I was going to my dad and stepmom's house every Wednesday night for dinner. And after he died, my stepmom said, are you still coming to over for dinner on Wednesday nights? And I said, well, of course. And she said, oh, I'm so glad. I was afraid that you weren't. I'm thinking, it's a free home-cooked meal. And my stepmom and I had become really close, and she became the mother that I always kind of wanted growing up, honestly. And after about 5 years, she met this man. His name's Herschel. My stepmom's about 5'11". She's got white hair, strong as an ox, superwoman. She looks like the former women's Tennessee basketball coach, Pat Summitt. Look her up. That's what my stepmom looks like. She said, listen, I met this man, and I want you to meet him. He's coming over for dinner Wednesday night. I said, okay. She goes, but listen, I need to tell you something. And I said, what? She goes, he's only about 5'6". I go, Mom, you may not have noticed, but I kind of like that. And sure enough, I meet Herschel. Baby blue eyes, dark skin, 5'6", dark hair, cute as a button. Super nice guy. A couple months later, I take my stepmom on a vacation in New York. We're traveling, we're walking around the streets of New York, taking in all the sights. And all of a sudden, I said, you know, I never thought you'd get married again, but I can kind of see you marrying Herschel. She goes, I could too. And sure enough, a couple months after that, she called me. And she said, hey, I need to talk to you about something. I said, you're getting married, aren't you? And she said, not if you're not ready. I know, isn't that sweet? She said, I know how much your daddy meant to you, and if this is too much for you, or if this is too soon, I can wait. And I said, Mom, don't ever give me that much power again. My daddy would have loved Herschel, and he would not want you to be alone, and I think that's great. And they got married. And about 5 years after they got married, everything was rocking and rolling and everything was going good. And my stepmom got sick and she wound up in the hospital, and they called me and they said, you need to get down to the emergency room. Mom can't breathe. And I was like, what is going on? And I get down there and sure enough, she's having trouble breathing. They've got her on oxygen. And so she's in the hospital for like 10 days straight. And this woman's never been sick a day in her life. I am not kidding you. Maybe a cold or something, but that's pretty much it. And so, they find out she has organized pneumonia in her lungs, and they start treating her for that. She was there for 10 days. She got back out. This was in October. She got back out of the hospital, and then she kept having problems and kept having to go back in the hospital. And she'd be in there for like 2 or 3 days, and then she'd be back out. And she was home for Thanksgiving, and then she went back in, and then she was home for Christmas, and then she went back in January. And in January, I go and see her at the hospital, and it's Monday night. And I go and see her after work. I'd been there about 2 hours. And then she said to me, don't you have a meeting to go to tonight? Because she knew when my home group was. Because she had come and heard me speak, and she had heard Cliff, and she had seen the changes in our life. She had seen who we had become. And she loved AA, and she loved Al-Anon. And I said, you know what, Mom, I could miss it tonight. And she said, no, you need to go. I was like, are you sure? She's like, yeah, I'm fine. And she was. They had taken her off the big oxygen. She was on the little nose cannula. She was doing great. I go, okay. And she says to me what she says to me every time we leave. We've been doing it for years. She says, "Don't forget that I love you." And I said, "I won't. I love you too." And she said, "Remember, and I will." And that's how I left. And at that time, Cliff had about 9 years sober, and we had some issues. You may not have heard about it down here in Louisiana, but Cliff became the sheriff of AA in Oklahoma. And he had stopped sharing his experience, strength, and hope, and started telling people how to do it. And his ego had gotten out of control, and I kicked him out of the house. Not because he drank, not because he used, not because he cheated on me. None of that stuff happened. But he became a man I did not know. And I had told him, "We're going to have a sober house, and that means in every area of our life, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, and physically, and we're going to have a sober life and a sober house." And so he got asked to leave our house, and he had been out of the house for about 3 months, and he had been doing some working with a sponsor and some other people in the program, and I'd asked him to come home that Friday, and he did. And the next morning we went up, and we went to a college basketball game, and I came home that afternoon, and I was tired, and I was going to lay down, and I got a call from Herschel. And he said, "Your mom's gone." And I wasn't expecting that. And Cliff took me to the hospital to say goodbye. And then the next day I was out at Herschel's house, Herschel and Mom's house. And it was just Herschel and I. And I'm going to tell you, I to this day, I cannot tell you why I asked this question. It's not something I would normally ask nor care about. But my stepmom had insisted on sleeping in her bed at the top of the stairs. And by the time that she had gotten to the top of the stairs, she literally would collapse in bed. So Herschel had gotten a chairlift, and it had gotten installed the day before she went to the hospital. And so I said to Herschel, "How much did you pay for that chairlift?" And he's like, "I don't know, like $2,700 or something." And I said, "And she got to use it one time." And without skipping a beat, he looked right at me and he said, "It was worth it." And that taught me this. No matter what happened in my life, no matter what pain I've caused others or what has been done to me, it was worth it if it got me here. I would not change one second of my life if it was going to cost me being here. Everything that I have in my life today is a direct result of my program and the God of my understanding, which I got here. I would not change a second. One more story and I'm done. My son, that year that my stepmom died, it was a horrible year. Every month we had something happen. It seemed like we just got hit over and over again. We had a murder-suicide family tragedy. We had we had to move our offices. We had 2 weeks' notice to move all of our offices, 6 floors. We had something happen. It was just like every month there was something. And my son got in a car wreck and it totaled his truck and he was fine. And he wanted me to give him the insurance check and I wouldn't do it. And he got mad and he left and he wouldn't talk to me. And I was calling him and he wouldn't answer his phone. And I was texting him I was blowing up his phone and he wouldn't text me back. And it's like I'd never been in a meeting of Al-Anon. All of a sudden I'm texting, "By God, I'll shut this phone off. You don't call me, sucker. I paid for this thing." I mean, real spiritual. And I'm just blowing and he won't call me back and he won't text me. And I finally, you get desperate enough, you call your sponsor. And so I did that and she said, "Okay, here's what we're going to do." And I'm just going to tell you the one thing that I've done, the only thing that I've done right in this whole thing is that I've always followed her direction, always. And I said, "Okay," because I knew she was going to have a good idea. And I said, "Okay, what?" She goes, "We're going to leave him alone." And I thought, that's a bad idea. And I was like, "What?" And I said, "It's not Cliff, it's Colby." She goes, "I heard you. We're going to leave him alone." And I was like, "Okay." Now, my son's not an alcoholic. He's just not. I thought he would marry one, but he didn't. But he's not an alcoholic. But anyway, he's one of the hardest people I work my program with. I'm just telling you, it's the toughest one. So I left him alone. I didn't talk to him for 3 months. At the end of 3 months, my sponsor goes, "Have you heard from Colby?" And I go, "No." She goes, "Here's what you can do. You get a card, and the only thing it can say is, 'I love you and I miss you, Mom.' That's it." I said, "Okay." And I got the card. It was my home group night. I had a sponsee, still my sponsee. Her best friend's husband worked with my son. And I gave her the card. Monday night, I said, "Can you get this to Colby?" She said, "Sure." Next morning, about 10 o'clock, my phone starts blowing up. My son's texting me, "Mom, I'm sorry. I was just mad. I really miss you, and I really miss Cliff. Do you think we could get together? I'd love to have dinner this week." I was so excited. So I called my sponsee. I said, "So you got Colby the card?" She said, "No, it's still in my car." And that's how God works in my life. I'm supposed to show up, follow directions, and get out of the way, and God always takes care of the rest. And for the life of me, I do not know why I still forget that and sometimes still think that I know best. But I'd still do that. We have a couple back home. They had Jack and Hody Mitchell, and Jack died with 42 years of sobriety, and Hody died with 36 years of sobriety, and she was also an Al-Anon member. And they were a great example of a couple in recovery, and we loved them. They're an American Indian couple, and Hody went to a conference in Arizona one time, or a meeting or something in Arizona one time, and she learned this prayer at an American Indian conference, and she brought it back to us. And they've been saying it for years, and there's still a few of us that know it, and I always close with it, and it goes like this. I've been told that the reason we join hands is to remind us of the truth that we are no longer alone. Our prayers for the still suffering alcoholics in these rooms and on the streets. Hold on to the hand next to you like your life depends on it, because someday it may. Thank you for holding my hand and allowing me to hold yours. Thank you.